The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
We absolutely support Israel's right to defend itself in line with international law.
We need to safeguard financial stability.
2024 is not going to be an easy year.
We used to call it the dream of home ownership, but look at Britain now.
We've got to hang on to optimism and hope because it is the biggest driver of change.
Let's stop thinking of life in terms of Brexit. Let's move on and look to the future.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Stephen Carroll.
And I'm Caroline Hepke. Welcome to the programme.
Always enjoy starting the week with a bang, don't you?
Yes.
It's nice to have some news of a Monday morning. Nice too, perhaps, for the Reform Party. They've got an MP now, after being without one essentially for the history of the party, largely, but the former deputy chairman of the Conservative Party, Lee Anderson, has joined Richard Tice's Reform Party. He had been suspended from the Tories over refusal to apologise for claims that Labour's Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, was controlled by Islamists. Here is Lee Anderson speaking at the Reform UK press conference a little earlier.
I think this party will allow me to speak on behalf of not just my constituents, who are furious with what's happening in that place, but millions of people up and down the country. My country has to come first, and I'm scared of what we're doing at the moment in this country. We are giving this country away, and it's got to stop.
So, the news then, Lee Anderson speaking there. It marks, of course, the third time that Anderson has changed party in 6 years after he originally switched from Labour to the Tories in 2018. So, joining us to discuss this morning is our political editor, Kitty Donaldson. Good morning, Kitty. How much of a boost, then, good morning, is this to the Reform Party?
Oh, it's clearly a boost to them because they've now got an MP, at least until the election. But probably not afterwards. Well, Anderson said in his press conference that he expects to hold his seat, but he expects he'll be with the Tory party on the opposition benches after the election. Whether he can hold his seat is an open question, I think.
I mean, for him, was this a very obvious political move for Lee Anderson to decide to switch his allegiance to the Reform Party, given that he'd been in quite a lot of trouble with the Conservatives?
Yeah, I mean, this comes as a surprise to absolutely nobody. I think for Reform UK, it's a coup in the sense that he's quite a high profile character, but he's clearly been on a political journey. As you said, he started off as a Labour spot. He's a son of a miner, and then he was in the Tory party and now defected to the party that's famous for supporting Nigel Farage. Actually, the interesting thing is I spoke to Nigel Farage about his plans a few weeks ago, and I said to him, look, are you going to stand as an MP in the election? And he said, no, because the election will probably coincide with the American election. And he wants to go over there and make some money, I think, to be a pundit or supporter of Donald Trump, who he's great mates with. So in the absence of Farage as a candidate, he's probably the most high profile of them all. Having Lee Anderson is a good second best.
Okay, so Lee Anderson is second best for Reform. But then what does it also mean for the Conservatives? Because obviously the other big question after recent by-elections has been how much of a challenge does Reform UK actually pose to the Conservatives? They're clearly trying to sort of pick off voters on perhaps more right-leaning.
So they kind of live rent-free in the Tories' heads, I think is the way I put it. The Tories worry about Reform in the areas, particularly up in the Red Wall, in seats that the Tories might lose back to Labour. I don't think Reform thought that they could possibly win an actual seat at the election, even though they talk a good game. I think this means it'll give them some more publicity. And also what tends to happen is it divides the vote in areas where there are, say, a sort of direct Tory-Labour fight or a Tory-Liberal fight. If you take votes away from the Tory, then another party tends to come through, which is why people like Lee Anderson were saying, even as long ago as January, so not that long ago, saying stuff like a vote for Reform is a vote for Keir Starmer because it will split the Tory vote. Clearly, he's changed his mind.
Yeah, I mean, the Reform Party leader, Richard Tice, was pretty gleeful in that press conference this morning. It was a series of interesting exchanges with the media after Lee Anderson made this announcement. I wonder what was your reading on it?
It's part of his whole kind of persona, isn't he, that the press are sort of part of kind of liberal elite. He was sort of joking and taking the mickey out of journalists and refusing to answer their questions. He's done that to me before. He's sort of notorious for accusing the press and as being part of the Westminster bubble. Perhaps he has a point. I don't know. But I'm not sure it's a brilliant strategy to go around insulting people who are about to go back to their desks and write a story about you. I mean, I don't think I'd do that.
Yeah, you know, talking about being someone who speaks out on behalf of millions of people and so on. So, yes, you can kind of see the sort of populist thread there also. What do you think is going to be the reaction from the Prime Minister? Do you think he's going to just ignore it? Or as you say, if the Conservatives are clearly quite worried about Reform UK, what do you think Sunak is going to say? Is there any play where this looks better for him?
I think if I was Sunak and if I were advising Sunak, I would just sort of downplay it as much as I could. I mean, it was always quite an odd alliance between Sunak and Anderson, actually, anyway, because Anderson was sort of employed as deputy party chairman to say the things that Sunak couldn't and make populist statements. And clearly he went too far when he made the comments about Islamists controlling London Mayor Sadiq Khan. I shouldn't be surprised if the next time Sunak pops up and does a clip with broadcasters, he will sort of either make a joke about it or downplay it.
Kitty, what's the kind of big picture that we can draw away from this? You've talked about how the vote can be split for the Conservative Party in constituencies where there's a duel with Labour. But is this potentially the start of further defections of a greater movement towards reform? Could we be developing another major political force in the UK?
The short answer is no, I don't think so. I think Anderson's probably very much on his own. There might be some Tory MPs who are tempted. There are certainly some who fall into that bracket, but quite a lot of Tories are now looking to life after the election, and they are taking soundings about the person they think can best represent them as leader of the opposition. And that is why people like Suella Braverman and Kevin Badenoch and others are kind of courting supporters for life after Sunak.
Will this embolden the likes of Kemi Badenoch and Suella Braverman to perhaps try and push out Rishi Sunak from the Conservative Party, or to at least make sure that their issues get higher up the agenda?
Yes, I think on the agenda there's clearly space for people to raise their concerns, and I think you'll see a lot of issues-based interventions. But I don't think you'll see any movement on actually trying to push him out, because no one is mad enough to want to do this job for 6 months and then be the person who pushed out Sunak and then lost the election. You want to start, if you're Kemi Badenoch or whoever else, you want to start again with a fresh sheet of paper after the election.
Yeah, absolutely. Kitty, thank you so much for being with us this morning, talking over then the statements from Lee Anderson, our political editor, Kitty Donaldson, and what may flow from that defection to Reform UK.
Now from one kind of race to another. The Cheltenham Festival, one of the biggest events in the horse racing calendar, kicks off tomorrow. But this year, the event faces new hurdles because of Brexit. Our Dublin reporter, Olivia Fletcher, has been writing about this, and she joins us now for more on this story. Not often, Olivia, that we get to combine horse racing and politics. Talk to us about the new challenges this festival is facing and what sort of effect it could have on this massive event.
Yeah, so it's part of the UK government's new plan to protect Britain's borders in the aftermath of Brexit. They introduced new staggered rules from the end of January, so there are still more to come. But essentially at this stage, it's just two extra bits of paperwork. generating a goods movement reference and signing up to the UK customs system online. And although that doesn't sound like much at this stage, it's still really quite annoying for horse trainers and shippers who were tasked with bringing some of probably the most expensive sought after horses in the world across the Irish Sea. And, you know, it's not just impacting horse transporters either. You know, it's anyone else in the EU who wants to import into Britain now. This doesn't just impact racehorses. It just makes things a little bit more onerous than they already were, because several other rules have already come in post-Brexit. You know, Ireland, for example, has already put in place rules for goods entering the country from Britain. So things are just a little bit more bureaucratic, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how prepared were the transporters? I mean, this is an immensely difficult task, isn't it? Getting these thoroughbreds across to, you know, the Gold Cup, St. Patrick's Day events as well. What have they been telling you about the extra red tape and how it's going to affect them?
Yeah, so hundreds of horses are probably travelling across the Irish Sea. All traders were made aware of the new so-called border target operator model in April last year. So to be fair, they've had time to prepare. But, you know, there's that famous Cockney saying, only fools and horses work, which basically means smart people will get their job done well by doing the least amount of graft possible, which I think is quite fitting because several horse transporters I spoke to said that this extra work they now have to do is unnecessary and that there should be some kind of trust model in place instead. I also asked Ashton Flynn, who works for George Mullins Transport, if the paperwork's got worse since Brexit.
Oh, 100%. 100%, yeah. And it's been difficult to get your head around customs and obviously runners going over, coming worth maybe a million or more, you know, than the average day-to-day horse.
And Ashlyn also told me that they'd been prepared for the additional paperwork as well. And I also visited Willie Mullins, brother of George Mullins, and also one of the most successful trainers in the history of the festival at his stables in County Carlow. And he told me that they'd been doing practice runs already in the lead up to the big event too. So long story short, transporters were prepared, but again, it's just a bit more onerous than before.
Olivia, what does this tell us about kind of the broader picture of the Anglo-Irish relationship? You know, these two very close neighbours, very complicated history. Is this the latest turn in that long history?
Well, this sport and this festival probably bonds the two countries together in ways that a lot of other things probably couldn't. Like you say, Stephen, it's had a complicated past. The festival is so culturally important. You know, it's the lifeblood of some Irish towns and villages, you know, and in Britain, the late Queen Elizabeth regularly used to attend this festival and she loved it. These rules and also the Irish border rules that had already come into force create friction for businesses like those horse transporters when the UK was in the EU practically didn't exist. And again, it's on top of other rifts that the two countries have had post-Brexit, you know, COF, Northern Ireland Protocol, COF. It just adds on to that.
Yeah, the thing is, I mean, I've been hearing for a few months from lots of organisations, you know, particularly the trade associations, really worried about another layer of Brexit rules, this time from within the UK rather than being imposed from Europe, but actually the checks coming in to Britain. It's not just going to apply, you know, to this very specific kind of horse transporter issue. It's going to affect a lot of business, isn't it?
Yeah, you're right. And it's already impacting businesses across Europe and also worldwide too. Like I already said, you know, it's just some additional paperwork at this stage, but there are SPS checks yet to come in and they will essentially be physical checks for some plant and animal categories. That will start coming in from April for some EU countries. And there's still quite a big concern over how this stage of the model will be implemented. Because obviously that's not just paperwork, you know, that could result in, you know, issues at ports. So yeah, one to watch. There's still more to come on this issue.
Yeah, definitely more developments there too. Olivia Fletcher, our Dublin reporter, thank you so much for joining us with the details of that story. You can read more of Olivia's reporting around Cheltenham as well on the Bloomberg website.
I just want to ask you whether you ever have a flutter on the horses. Are you a betting man?
No.
No.
I was wondering what St. Patrick's Day events you go to that our horse is at.
Cheltenham.
Yes, I mean, Cheltenham coincides there. I was like, wait, hold on. I've been to lots of St. Patrick's Day events. I've never seen any special invitation horses.
Oh, special guests.
Anyway, you can tell it's a Monday morning. Let's turn to another story that we have been following on the programme for you.
So this is about the UK's biggest companies becoming more diverse. I wanted to bring you this because it's a really interesting story. The Parker Review's voluntary census for last year, for 2023, is carried out jointly with the Department for Business and Trade. So they look at ethnic diversity on boards at the UK's top 250 listed firms. And actually, the report does show some progress. So I think it's sort of worth underlining. 12 FTSE 100 CEOs are now from an ethnic minority background. That's up from 7 in 2022. So Bloomberg reporter Tiwa Adebayo and I were speaking to David Tyler, who is the co-chair of the Parker Review. He spoke to us this morning about how big the changes are. There is also a big political element to this because of the Labour Party view on reporting and how you assess diversity within company organisations. But have a listen to this. He's talking about, you know, this big change and what it actually means.
96% of the FTSE 100 have at least one ethnic minority director today. In fact, 56 of the 100 have two or more. So, you know, there are a lot more ethnic minority directors in big companies. Indeed, 19% of the total number of directors at FTSE 100 companies now come from ethnic minority directors, which is up again from last year. As you say, the FTSE 250 is making good progress, but there's still more to do if they're to make their target, which is for the end of this year, December 24, for at least one ethnic minority director in all of those companies. We're at 70% today of all the companies, and a little bit more needs to be done clearly to reach our target in 9 months' time.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? This is a voluntary census. What are the participation rates like? Why do you think there's been this improvement that you highlight?
Well, I think because companies believe it's in their own interest. They think with a mix of ethnicities and other diversity around the table, they're simply likely to have a wider, more informed and higher quality debate. And that means that they make better decisions. I also think that they believe that they'll understand their own markets better if their own management team reflects the mix of consumers in those markets. And thirdly, they see that companies which embrace all the talents of our society, of whatever background, will gain a competitive advantage over those that don't do so. So for all of those reasons, we're pushing at a relatively open door. It makes sense for business to do this, and it's good for society.
David, I just want to ask you a bit more about the data. So the report shows that there are now 12 ethnic minority CEOs in the FTSE 100, and 13% of senior management at FTSE 100 companies come from ethnic minority backgrounds. Relatively speaking, do you think that number is still a little bit low, considering that 18% of the population are from ethnic minorities? So what more needs to be done to bring those numbers up?
Yes, well, I think we're seeing good progress. Rome wasn't built in a day. So as far as CEOs are concerned, last year when I was talking about this, 12 months ago, there are only 7 ethnic minority CEOs in the FTSE 100. So we've seen quite a leap to 12. And the figure of 13% of senior management you just quoted, well, this is the first time we've ever authoritatively been able to provide this figure. So again, it's interesting to look at that and compare it to the level in the population. So the population as a whole is around 17% today. 13% is obviously lower than that, so it's not an acceptable long-term objective. But I think we have to remember within the population, there's a much higher percentage among lower age cohorts, and the higher percentage there will come through automatically as well. So part of it will be simply self-correcting as ethnic minority people get into their, if you like, 40s and 50s when they're more likely to be in these positions. But there's more to do, and all I'm able to say today, I'm glad that we're seeing the progress we're seeing.
There has been a pushback against DEI, I'm sure you're aware, especially in the United States, against the idea of the commercial benefits of diversity in businesses from some very influential US investors too. Should the number of people from diverse backgrounds, or I mean, it could be applied also to gender, but just from ethnically diverse backgrounds, should the number exactly reflect the percentage in society? Should there be that sort of proportional representation? Is that the aim?
No, it isn't have proportional representation. It's to make sure that everybody has equal opportunities. And that's the watchword that we operate with. We want everybody to be promoted on the basis of their capability and their potential. Sometimes the potential of people who've grown up in disadvantaged circumstances is not quite taken into account enough, in my view, by some companies when recruiting. But whatever you see, you hear in the US about DE&I, let me tell you that in the UK, companies are interested in having diverse management teams and diverse boards because they see it's in their own interest, not just in the interest of society as a whole. And whatever people may say, simply finding the best possible talent from all of our society makes a lot of natural sense to most of us.
David, this report focuses on the number of ethnic minority CEOs and senior managers in the FTSE, but I want to get your thoughts on the ethnic minority pay gap, specifically around reporting. So Labour's proposal for a Race Equality Act would include mandatory reporting of ethnic pay gap data for firms with more than 250 staff. Is this something that you support? Is it necessary?
Is it necessary? We've survived without it, if you like. But I think having gender pay reporting and looking at the gap there has been helpful at focusing senior management, focusing boards on where there may be differences. And so I can understand that people would like to bring this ethnic pay gap reporting in as well. I think it needs to be done with care if it's done. And it obviously requires data. Every company, without almost any exception, knows the gender of its employees. Not every company knows the ethnic background of it. And when employees are asked, of course, some people do say they prefer not to say, and they've got every right to do that. So we've just got to be a little careful about the way we take this forward if that's what does happen under a potential new government.
Okay. In terms of that and the comparisons to the gender pay gap reporting, that has been really quite revolutionary for the UK. I was interviewing Harriet Baldwin, MP, chair of the Treasury Select Committee, after their recent review into women in financial services on Friday. And I did detect there were some fresh recommendations from that big piece of work, but the view was still that the progress has been at a snail's pace and incredibly slow. And, you know, although perhaps for ethnic minority members of boards that may have been better, there's still a kind of concern that it's one and done, that it's a compliance issue, that it is box ticking, and that there may be a bit of a pushback against actually hard data collection and hard enforcement. Do you detect that kind of rowback?
Well, certainly I don't detect it in among ethnic minorities. And, you know, obviously my focus here is on that rather than gender, though, of course, as an individual and as a chair of companies, I'm very interested in the gender issue as well. In generally, we are seeing an increase in numbers of ethnic minority directors, not just one and done. As I think I've already said in this broadcast, 56 of the FTSE 100 have more than one ethnic minority director, which suggests they are recruiting on merit, on the basis of the people that come in front of them, rather than simply to achieve a target. And now we're focusing in the Parker Review on senior management as well. We believe that the same result will take place, that people will focus more on it and take more interest in it, because if they don't, they're not going to have the finest mix of potential employees in their business, and their business will not be as competitive as some of its rivals.
So that was David Tyler, the co-chair of the Parker Review, speaking to Bloomberg Radio today. Look, I thought it was really interesting. He highlights the progress that the UK is making in terms of the ethnic diversity of people in these leadership positions. And I do think, you know, we should really underline that big progress has been made in a year. I think my concerns are around, does that stall at some point? I was talking, for example, to Harriet Baldwin MP, that Treasury Select Committee chair, only on Friday when it was International Women's Day. And if you think about sort of intersectionality, if you, you know, then you do have to think that actually when it comes to gender diversity in the city and financial services, for example, it's really stalled. So there's sort of a question about and a tension between how much you leave it up to the leadership of the companies, how much is it imposed? And this Parker Review, of course, is voluntary. Yeah, so it's a kind of a difficult area for what you see as progress and how you make progress.
Yeah, indeed. And the question too of when you set targets at very high levels of companies as well, are you creating the pipeline of people that are able to fill those jobs as well, that manage to lift diversity across those kind of top tier management positions as well? So definitely an interesting story to watch for progress on.
Well, that's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe, give it 5 stars so that other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by Tiwa Adebayo. Our audio engineers were Marufal Hussain and Sean Guastamacchia. I'm Stephen Carroll.
And I'm Caroline Hetke. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.